of power have never travelled well together, but that would have been a gradually diminishing problem if we'd stuck with the English model. We haven't, and it's perhaps that simple fact that brings us here today. We've got three well-known speakers. I'm not going to go through their biographical notes, but I will make a comment that there is a certain rounded quality to the presentation of the papers. Duncan Kerr will start off with Charles I, as I understand it, and Simon Evans will be in the middle with no references to kings or queens, but Peter Gerangelis will end up with what happens when we get Charles III. Yes, Duncan will explain the potential threat to the rule of law posed by the open-ended model, if I can call it that, that we've chosen rather than the English model. Simon will say that Duncan's a bit too pessimistic. And Peter will canvass what might happen if and when we finally wave goodbye to Charles III. So I call on Duncan.
Well, it was in 1649 that Charles I went to his death, utterly convinced of his divine right as a king, declaring on the scaffold, "A sovereign and a subject are clean different things." And 3 decades before that, his father, James I, had set down in writing the legal and political doctrine his son was to die for. He said, "Kings are justly called gods, for that they exercise a manner or resemblance of divine power on earth. God hath power to create or destroy, make or unmake, at his pleasure, to give life or send death, to judge all and to be judged, nor accountable to none. And kings and the like power have kings, accountable to none but God only." Yet notwithstanding James I's claim to rule by divine right, it was during his reign that the status of the crown was first explicitly stated to be subject to the law. In the case of proclamations, it was resolved by the two chief justices, Chief Baron and Baron Altham, upon conference betwixt the Lords and the Privy Council and them, that the King by his proclamation cannot create any offence which was not an offence before, and the King hath no prerogative but that the law of the land allows him. Charles's execution was briefly followed by republican rule, but it was the almost bloodless, glorious revolution which, after the Restoration, removed James II and installed William and Mary as joint sovereigns, but subject to the Declaration of Right and the powers of the Parliament, that finally ended all plausible claims for the Crown to govern Britain other than as a constitutional monarchy. By 1867, Badgett was describing the Crown as exercising only the dignified component of the British Constitution. Today, the modern British monarchy may lack even that dignity, but it is centuries beyond those ancient times when a king or queen exercised personal rule and might lament, as the words Shakespeare put in the mouth of King Henry IV, "Uneasy lies the head that wears a crown." In 1964, Lord Diplock bluntly dismissed the argument that the British Crown could assert a monopoly over broadcasting with a statement, "It is 350 years and a civil war too late for the Queen's Court to broaden the prerogative." Yet the position in Australia has recently changed, and it now appears starkly different. In a recent article in the Australian Bar Review, the Chief Justice of New South Wales, writing extrajudicially, observed, "The extent of the executive power of the Commonwealth appears to have been cut free from the traditional conception of prerogative powers in a manner which means that there is now no source of guidance as to the boundaries of executive power." His Honour continued, "In terms of our legal history, this is quite a dramatic development. In England, a king was executed and a civil war waged to limit the scope of the prerogative and to assert the supremacy of Parliament. However, the executive power is, in Australia, no longer confined to well-established traditional categories." The three presentations in this session will explore the implications of cutting free Australia from historic notions of limited prerogative powers. And my contribution will seek to explain how that circumstance arose, its significance, and to identify what has been resolved and to look at what remains unresolved in consequence of those changes. Simon Evans is to follow and will propose a theory to underpin a direction that the law may and should follow. And Peter Girandolos will conclude this session by exploring how Australia's ultimate evolution to a republic might intersect with an evolving understanding of executive power. If we can start with Section 61 and look at how it has evolved from imperial doctrine to this present constitutional conundrum. Section 61 of the Constitution is cryptic as to what the content is of executive power. Its terms are as simply as follows. The executive power of the Commonwealth is vested in the Queen and is exercisable by the Governor-General as the Queen's representative and extends to the execution and maintenance of this Constitution and of the laws of the Commonwealth. The actual constitutional law, role of the Queen and her Governor-General and the nature of executive power that can be exercised by them therefore cannot be discerned by simply reading the text of the Constitution. Assumptions, implications, and unwritten conventions deriving from doctrines such as responsible government and from the principle of the rule of law both form part of the fabric upon which the written words of the Constitution are superimposed. The doctrine of responsible government and the conventions associated with it serve to restrain the exercise of any significant personal power by the Governor-General. But the notion of responsible government says little about the content and scope of those powers. When the Commonwealth of Australia was formed in 1901, the primacy of the Constitution was axiomatic because the Constitution was then regarded as an enactment of the Imperial Parliament and therefore binding on all colonial institutions. Justice Isaacs explained the then orthodox position as follows. I apprehend, therefore, it is the duty of this Court as the chief judicial organ of the Commonwealth to take judicial notice in interpreting the Australian Constitution of every fundamental British constitutional doctrine existing and fully recognised at the time the Constitution was passed, and therefore to be taken as influencing the meaning in which its words were used by the Imperial Legislature. Now, applying that doctrine inevitably led to the conclusion that the executive power conferred by Section 61 included aspects of the Crown's prerogative powers. The prerogative was that bundle of rights possessed by the Crown quite distinct from the rights of common persons. Over time, as the divine rights of kings had been displaced by the notion of responsible government, the prerogative became to be seen less as an element of individual royal power and more as an ordinary aspect of government. And the early jurisprudence of the High Court was to the effect that the prerogative powers of the Crown possessed by the British monarch at the time of the making of the Constitution, as were capable of application in Australia, had been conveyed to the Governor-General by Section 61 and were exercisable by him or her as if he or she was a constitutional monarch. So Justice Isaac said of Section 61, these provisions carry with them the royal prerogative, royal war prerogative, and all that the common law of England includes in that prerogative insofar as it is applicable to Australia. Now, that understanding of the discretionary powers conferred by Section 61 carried with it a number of legal consequences which are consistently with which we regard as the rule of law. Firstly, the prerogative powers were vestigial. They were left over from medieval times when the English kings ruled as absolute monarchs, but residual, so that they could be lost by disuse or abolished by statute, and no new prerogative powers could be created. Second, the scope of the prerogative was justiciable. And thirdly, all the powers included within the prerogative were capable of identification and classification. But the view of Section 61 as limited by the prerogative was intimately bound up with the early High Court's conception of the legitimacy of the Constitution deriving from its status as imperial legislation. And once the Constitution's binding power was held not to derive from imperial law, but from a mandate sourced exclusively in the original adoption and subsequent maintenance of its provisions by the people, as it now is by the High Court, there was refocused judicial attention on the text. In a critical point of departure from earlier references to the prerogative, Justice Gummow, then a judge of the Federal Court, reasoned, in Australia one looks not to the content of the prerogative in Britain, but rather to Section 61, by which the executive power of the Commonwealth was vested in the Crown. And that revolution in thinking made it possible to imagine that a reading of 61 that could differ from the position asserted by the late Professor George Winterton, who wrote, "The government is limited by those powers falling within the Crown's prerogative powers. In other words, the government can maintain the Constitution and the laws of the Commonwealth only to the extent allowed by the Crown's prerogative powers." With the new doctrine, was it possible that the Australian Governor-General might exercise actually greater discretionary and arbitrary powers than could the Queen, who he or she represented, and in whose name the powers were to be exercised? A case known as Vardalis elevated that question from theoretical speculation to practical importance. Vardalis arose in politically charged circumstances. A Norwegian vessel, the Tampa, was boarded by the Australian Defence Forces, acting on instructions from the government to prevent it making port in Australia and discharging 433 asylum seekers. If the power to undertake that action existed, the source of the power to do so had to be located outside that conferred by statute. The Migration Act of 1958 conferred neither the power to authorise the vessel's boarding or the detention of the asylum seekers. And Mr. Vardalis, a Victorian solicitor acting pro bono, sought orders in the nature of habeas corpus in the federal court seeking their release. At first instance, Justice North granted that application. His Honour gave short shrift to the claim that an executive power to detain and remove those aboard the Tampa existed. He said, "The Migration Act contains comprehensive provisions concerning the removal of aliens. In my view, the Act was intended to regulate the whole area of removal of aliens. The long title of the Act is An Act Relating to the Entry into and Presence in Australia of Aliens and the Departure or Deportation from Australia of Aliens and Certain Other Persons. It leaves no room for the exercise of any prerogative power on the subject," and he referred to the leading case of Attorney General in De Keyser's Royal Hotel. The Minister appealed. Two critical questions fell for determination by the full court of the Federal Court of Australia. They were, first, whether the Commonwealth Executive possessed any power independent of statute to prevent the entry of aliens, and if so, whether that power had been displaced by the detailed provisions of the Migration Act. A majority, Justice French, later to be elevated to the High Court of Australia as its Chief Justice, and Beaumont, upheld the Minister's appeal. Their honours concluded that the necessary executive power existed. Referring to the reasoning of Justice Gummow in Re Ditforth, that I'd referred to earlier, Justice French rejected the proposition that any source of the executive's power to exclude aliens must be an aspect of the prerogative. His Honour stated, "The executive power of the Commonwealth under Section 61 cannot be treated as an aspect of the royal prerogative. While the executive power may derive some of its content by reference to the royal prerogative, it is a power conferred as part of a negotiated federal compact expressed in a written constitution," and went on to say, "There is no place, therefore, for any doctrine that a law made on a particular subject is presumed to displace or regulate the operation of the executive power in respect to the subject matter." So it was immaterial whether or not a prerogative power existed to expel aliens, whether it had ever existed or had been lost through disuse. The prerogative did not constrain Section 61's bounds. The problem of how to identify this additional content was dealt with cursorily, Justice French stating, "The spheres of responsibility vested in the Crown by the Constitution and referred to by Justice Mason in Barton were described in Davis as derived from the distribution of legislative powers affected by the Constitution itself and from the character and status of the Commonwealth as a national polity." In like vein, Justice Brennan agreed generally with the observation of Justice Jacobs in Victoria and the Commonwealth and Hayden that the phrase "maintenance of the Constitution" imports the idea of Australia as a nation. Justice Brennan saw the phrase as assigning to the executive government functions relating not only to the institutions of government, but more generally to the protection and advancement of the Australian nation. So, included in the armoury of the executive acting under Section 61 was all that flowed from the conception of Australia as a nation and from the Constitution's assignment to the executive of the role of promoting the nation's protection and advancement. But both Davis and the AAP case that were referred to had concerned legislative rather than executive power, and so the direct relevance of the cases was contestable. There are persuasive rule of law reasons to reject an easy analogy between the executive and legislative power. In a recent essay, Stephen Gagler suggested that the High Court's approach should differ depending on whether or not it is foreseeable that political accountability can be relied on to resolve contending views of the appropriate balance and constraint on government powers. Now, if Gagler's thesis is accepted, there's a rational, if rarely articulated, reason as to why many otherwise plausible arguments about the invalidity of legislation passed by a representative and bicameral parliament will be rejected by the High Court, their merits being left for political rather than judicial determination. But an equally powerful reason, given that the executive has come to dominate the House of Representatives, such that there is little effective parliamentary check through their processes on such power, why strict judicial review should apply to any claimed additional discretionary executive powers which would otherwise be uncoupled from effective review. But whatever criticisms can be made of the reasoning in Vardalis, the majority concluded that the executive power conferred by Section 61 extended beyond the prerogative. It authorised the military to board the Tampa and to prevent the asylum seekers coming into Australia. Justice French said, "In my opinion, absent statutory authority, there is such a Section 61 power, at least to prevent entry into Australia. It is not necessary for present purposes to consider its full extent." Chief Justice Black dissented, criticising the reasoning of the majority as leaving little or no room for the underlying notions such as the rule of law and responsible government to operate. And Chief Justice Black identified the novel constitutional significance of the majority's conclusions by saying this, that if it be accepted that the asserted executive power to exclude aliens in time of peace is at best doubtful at common law, the question arises whether Section 61 of the Constitution provides some larger scope of a power. It would be a very strange circumstance if at best doubtful and historically long unused power to exclude or expel should emerge in a strong modern form from Section 61 of the Constitution by virtue of general conceptions of the national interest. This is all the more so when, according to English constitutional theory, no new prerogative power can be created. The issue of executive power first came before the High Court after these considerations in the decision in Pape. And Pape's important for many other reasons, but insofar as this discussion is concerned, is that the majority of the High Court applied a similar approach to the source of executive power as had the majority of the full court of the Federal Court in Vardalis. The litigation in Pape challenged the validity of the Tax Bonus for Working Australia's Act, passed by the Parliament as part of a package of urgent measures the government argued as necessary to provide economic stimulus to the economy and to prevent Australia falling into recession. The Act provided for lump sum payments of a minimum of $250 to be made to all persons with a tax liability of at least $1 in the then current year. The plaintiff, a legal academic, and I welcome him here today, issued a writ seeking a declaration that the tax bonus legislation was invalid. The case was given expedition, and on the 3rd of April 2009, the High Court, by a 4-3 majority, delivered judgment in favour of the validity of the Act. But on the 7th of July 2009, the Court published its reasons, and those reasons revealed that the judges had surprisingly but unanimously rejected the arguments of the Commonwealth that Section 81 was a grant of power to the Parliament to appropriate from the consolidated revenue. And that issue having been resolved against the Commonwealth, the High Court had been required to consider whether it might be incidental to the executive power vested in the Governor-General by Section 61 for the Parliament to legislate to appropriate the Consolidated Revenue Fund to permit the executive to spend public money to respond to the then global crisis. And in the event, the legislation only survived because a majority of the High Court accepted it was so appropriate to an incidental power that was existing in the executive. The majority, Chief Justice French, Justices Gummo, Crennan and Bell, concluded that the executive power authorised the Commonwealth to undertaking short-term measures to meet adverse economic conditions affecting the nation as a whole. The joint majority judgment emphasised that the executive was the arm of government most capable and empowered to respond to any national crisis, whether it was war, natural disaster or economic crisis. Now, aspects of that notion were far from novel. Executive power has always been permitted to expand when required in the defence of the nation. Extraordinary powers have been reposed in the executive and accepted as legitimate by the High Court at times of war. But whether the exigencies of war provided an appropriate analogy to an economic crisis can be doubted, and I'll return to that later in this discussion. Chief Justice French explained his understanding of the Commonwealth executive power as follows. Section 61 is an important element of a written constitution for the government of an independent nation. While history and the common law inform its content, it is not a locked display cabinet in a constitutional museum. It is not limited to statutory powers and the prerogative. It has to be capable of serving the proper purposes of a national government. Justices Gummo, Crennan and Bell similarly argued that Section 61 conferred powers extending beyond those that had been historically identified as the prerogative. Their honours premised their conclusion that Section 61 permitted the executive to act to combat the financial crisis on the fact that only the national government had the necessary resources to meet the then economic emergency. As had the majority in Vardalis, their honours adopted the statement of Justice Brennan in Davis and the Commonwealth that I've referred to you. However, a criteria as to whether an activity is of such that it is to engage in enterprises and activities peculiarly adapted to the government of a nation and which cannot otherwise be carried on for the benefit of the nation involves contestable judicial choices. The dissidents disputed the majority's underlying premise, observing that words like crisis and emergency do not readily yield criteria for constitutional validity. The minority judgments made strong claims that an equally effective economic stimulus package could have been delivered had the Commonwealth simply used uncontroversial powers and taken advantage of its financial entitlement to make grants on conditions to the states. And therefore, even accepting that there was a financial crisis requiring a national response, the minority nonetheless concluded that the provision of financial stimulus was not an activity which cannot otherwise be carried on for the benefit of the nation. And accordingly, their honours found there had been no occasion for any expansion of executive power. The result in PAPE was to confirm that there was no longer any prospect of the High Court going back to a notion that the prerogative formed a limiting boundary to the power conferred by Section 61, but it also highlighted that the limits of the powers that were conferred by Section 61 remained unknown, unpredictable and unsettled. Now, I should take you to some of the probable and possible restraints on this arbitrary and capricious power that has emerged. The reasoning of the majority in both Vardalis and PAPE releases the discretionary and arbitrary power vested in the Australian Governor-General from the known bounds of the prerogative. If there are limits, they must be discerned by interrogating the Delphic terms of Section 61, subject, of course, to constitutional prohibitions. And as Justice Spiegelman observed in the paper I mentioned earlier, the delineation of the court of the permissible scope of executive power may have to await development on a case-by-case basis. But in the judgments of Pape, there are a number of obiter statements that justify considerable confidence that the court will exercise caution before further arbitrary power is conceded to the executive. And there are also indications that a number of older cases that serve to limit Commonwealth's recourse to executive power will continue in force, not as a limitation imposed by the prerogative, but under a new guise. Chief Justice French stated explicitly that future questions about the application of the executive power to control or regulate conduct or activities under coercive law, absent the authority conferred by statute or made under some head of power other than Section 5139, alone are likely to be answered conservatively. And he referred to the remarks of Dixon in the Communist Party case that history, and not only ancient history, shows that in countries where democratic institutions have been unconstitutionally superseded, it has been done not seldom by those holding executive power. His Honour noted that Section 61 could not operate to set aside the distribution of powers between the Commonwealth of the States or the distribution of powers between the three branches of the federal government, nor could it abrogate any constitutional prohibitions. Whether His Honour's reference to the Communist Party case was intended to imply that an aspects of the rule of law that Chief Justice Dixon referred to were within the notion of constitutional prohibitions remains Delphic. The joint judgment of Justices Gummow, Crennan and Bell reaffirmed, but without identifying any doctrinal basis, their support for the authority of earlier decisions of the High Court, which had upheld the incapacity of the executive government to dispense with the obedience of the law and imposing a need for statutory authority to support extradition from Australia of fugitive offenders. Their Honours also noted the statement by Chief Justice Latham in the pharmaceutical benefits case that the executive government of the United Kingdom cannot create a new offence. And their Honours appear to have approved of that conclusion, that it applies in Australia. But even acknowledging that these obiter statements, important obiter statements, large questions remain to be answered. If the known ambit of prerogative power no longer expresses the content of the unregulated element of executive power conferred by Section 61 of the Constitution, how are future boundaries to be discerned, and what might be a coherent modern rationale for the acceptance by the majority joint judgment of the authority of the earlier different premised decisions of the High Court? A paper I have prepared also takes attention to the second limb of the Vardalis case, where the majority in that case held that the detailed provisions in the Migration Act had not displaced the Section 61 executive power. In the view of Chief Justice Black dissenting, the decision of the majority had constituted an arguable and disputed prerogative power to a constitutional grant under Section 61, which could only be removed by unambiguous legislative language. And I examine in the paper a number of cases which do appear now quite conclusively to show that the High Court has taken a view that where there is comprehensive legislation on a subject, it does in fact extinguish Section 61 powers, whether they flow from a conception of the prerogative or flow from the larger idea of the powers necessary to govern the country in times of crisis or the like. In particular, the decision in Vardalis had been based on language found in Oates and the Attorney General, where a full court of the High Court of Australia referred with apparent approval to Justice Mason's view in Barton and the Commonwealth that the Parliament is not supposed to abrogate a prerogative of the Crown unless it does so by express words or necessary intendment. But I point out that Oates appears to be no longer a good authority for that proposition, referring to two cases, the first, Jarrett and the Commissioner of Police, where the New South Wales government, seeking to rely on the Crown's prerogative to dismiss its servants, a senior police officer, was held not to be effective. The High Court reiterating and reinforcing the principle that where a prerogative of the executive government is directly regulated by statute, the executive can no longer rely on the prerogative power but must act in accordance with the statutory regime. And a second case, Northern Territory and Arnhem Land Trust, where a similar principle was expressed. Both the most recent cases, including the latter, where a majority of the justices were the same membership as in Oates, taking a different view, I think it's pretty clear that we can take it that where a statutory and wide legislative scheme has been enacted, it overrides the prerogative or the Section 61 powers. I want to conclude with quickly taking you through what I want to raise by way of some of the issues that are most significant in terms of philosophical considerations. I noted earlier, and I'm just going to terrorise the chair by taking a couple more minutes. As noted earlier, legislative power has always been permitted to expand in times of war in defence of the realm. But whether the exigencies of war is an analogy appropriate for peacetime expansion of executive power through coupling Section 61 with the incidental legislative power conferred by Section 5139 may be doubted. The analogy cannot hold unless Commonwealth legislation in time of war or in response to threats such as terrorism can be supported otherwise than having its roots in the defence power. And in the paper, I take you through a discussion which examines the single contention that has ever been so put by Isaacs in a case called Fowey and Burvett that suggested there was an independent executive power to respond to exigencies of war. But the response of Blackshield and Williams, that although these suggestions have some later resonance in the nationhood power, they have never been tested. And in a more recent case in Thomas and Mowbray, the High Court referred exclusively to the defence power in circumstances where if it existed, an implied executive power to protect the Constitution from sedition might have been at least suggested. And to the extent that PAPE opens the door to the use of the incidental power to respond to any national crisis, it poses a challenging conundrum. If the executive is entitled to claim that new powers are needed to respond to an emergency and can then legislate in support of that claimed need, the whole process may be criticised as self-referential and akin to the executive reciting itself into power. If that's possible, it poses very difficult questions as to how such a power could be limited. As Justice Hayne and Kiefel's dissent in PAPE illuminates, public claims of crisis or emergency are often made, but such words are difficult to read as construing criteria for constitutional validity. An objection to making the conclusion of the legislature final and the measure of its own power underpinned Justice Dixon's reluctance to sanction legislation incidental to an implied power to protect the Constitution in the Communist Party case. So logically, a similar objection to the executive setting the measure of its own powers should be equally or more important. How this fundamental tension will be resolved in future cases remains to be seen. The paper also addresses what is a clear tension, a problem of separation of powers, given the political involvement that the court must make if it ever is placed in a position of having to adjudicate such claims. In PAPE, Justice Hayden apprehended the difficulty of dealing with such issues as a reason for rejecting all such claims. His Honour said the public is continually told that it is facing decisive junctures, crucial turning points and critical decisions. And His Honour went on to say it would be regrettable if the field was one where the courts deferred to and declined to substitute their judgment for the opinion of the executive or the legislature. That would be to give an unexaminable power to the executive. On the other hand, if the courts do not defer to the executive or the legislature, it would be difficult to assess what would be within and what is without power. I make the point, however, that the court has decided that there is such a power, and it seems unthinkable, given the approach of the High Court in cases such as plaintiff S157, that the court could permit an unrestrained executive power not subject to review. To do so would be unthinkable. But it does force the court to stray very close to the boundaries or over the boundaries of political decision-making. As has been observed on numerous occasions, the historical arrangements that formed the boundaries of prerogative powers were the result of political struggle rather than any action of the courts. I'll conclude very briefly by saying that this paper doesn't purport to touch on some of the great complexities left of executive power. It doesn't touch on state executive powers. Kirk now means that state executive powers are subject to judicial review in a like manner as those exercised by officers of the Commonwealth. Nor have I referred to powerful criticisms by the former Chief Justice of the High Court, Sir Anthony Mason, that the High Court has unnecessarily limited the grounds for judicial review in Australia by adhering to the requirements for proof of jurisdictional error. I've not looked at what is an increasingly pressing question, given the trend to outsource government functions, of whether the British doctrine in DataFin applies to extend judicial review to private bodies, and we haven't looked at whether the Parliament will try once again to exclude judicial review on refugee claims, again fruitlessly attempted and struck down by the High Court in plaintiff M61 2010E in the Commonwealth. But I hope enough has been said this afternoon to allow the suggestion to be made that the High Court of the early 21st century is likely to be as much engaged about thinking about Chapter 2 of the Constitution and the nature and scope of executive power as it has been regarding Chapter 3 and the nature and scope of judicial power. Thank you.
Duncan suggested that I was going to offer a theory of the prerogative. You may be glad that a theory of executive power and how it might be constrained. You may be glad to hear it at 4:10 on a Friday afternoon. I'm not going to delve into theory and stick rather more mundanely with the cases, which, with Duncan, I agree, are significant and troubling. However, I don't fully agree with the reading of the cases that Duncan has given, and what I want to use my 20 minutes to focus on are those areas where I suggest there is still some room for debate or room to pull back from the full horrors that he suggested might come from a broad reading of the recent decisions on the executive power. Specifically, I want to take up his suggestion that the reasoning of the majority in Vidalis and Pape releases the discretionary and arbitrary power vested in the Australian Governor-General from the known bounds of the prerogative. I want to tell this story in four chapters. I'm going to give you the rather long chapter headings. The chapters aren't long, the headings are long. In case I run out of time midway through chapter two, in which case you can have enough clues to ask questions about chapters three and four. Chapter one, Vidalis and Pape are, in fact, or should have been, very different cases. Unfortunately, there is a conflation of at least language in both cases that undermines their distinctiveness and helps to lead to the conclusion that Duncan draws about the breadth of what they stand for. Chapter two, secondly, there is much that, in fact, is positive about the view of executive power in those cases, and earlier in Ditfurth and later in Cadia, specifically in the suggestion that Section 61 is not to be treated as a species of the royal prerogative. I think the news is not all bad. Chapter 3, The Worm Turns, that is not to accept all or even most of the reasoning in those cases about the character of Commonwealth executive power. The Ditfurth Vidalis Pape Dicta, the French Gummo view, revives, in my view, a 17th century approach to the prerogative that's deeply troubling in a modern democratic state. In Chapter 4, the punchline, that view should be rejected. But even if it's not, we should not accept a characterization of executive power as discretionary and arbitrary. Whether our constitutional tradition is one of legal liberalism, as increasingly it seems to be, at least on the legal side, perhaps not so liberal, with strong judicial review, or civic republican, with greater emphasis on political accountability for the exercise of government power, it should emphatically reject arbitrary power. So, Chapter 1, Vidalis and Pape are different cases. Here I want to step back a little from the language in those cases that Duncan referred to and go back to the earlier characterization of the structure of executive power. The reason I want to do that is that there are, in any of these cases about executive power in a federation, there are two issues. One is the structure of executive power, and the second is the spheres of responsibility in which those different components of executive power can be exercised. The two dimensions that George Winterton famously labelled as breadth and depth. Oh, pardon, depth and breadth, if I'm saying in that order. So the classic modern articulation of the structure of executive power appears in Justice Brennan's judgment in Davis. And there he distinguished between three different components of Commonwealth executive power. First, prerogative in the narrow sense, I'm going to call it, the powers possessed by the Crown alone. Some of these powers affect legal rights. Some are coercive. Some are personal privileges and rights, in the UK, the right to swans and whales and sturgeon. Some are constitutional. But this is only category one. This is the prerogative in the strict or narrow sense. This is the prerogative that's been progressively limited by constitutional development since the 17th century. The second structural component of the executive power are capacities, the powers possessed by all legal persons, the Crown, the executive government, and you and me. These powers, labelled the dominium powers by Paul Craig and others, include the power to own property, to enter contracts, to dispose of property, and critically, I would say for Pape, the power to spend money. It's those two structural, I'm not going to take time over the third, that I want to distinguish. The reason that I distinguish them is that too often they are conflated together as the prerogative, conflated together as the arbitrary and discretionary powers of the Crown. But I think they are different and distinctive. They both pose very great difficulties, but their differences are shown up by Vidalis and Pape. Vidalis always necessarily was a case involving the prerogative in the first strict or narrow sense. Why? Because it involved a claim that the Crown could, or the government could, use a non-statutory power in a coercive manner. The second type, the second category of executive power, the capacities, do not include that coercive element. That case, therefore, in the breadth of its language, did involve either the resuscitation of a moribund prerogative in the strict sense, or a new account of what the executive power involved, a coercive power to meet the needs of a modern nation, particularly in securing its borders. It is therefore a deeply troubling case for anyone who wants to hang on to a modest and constitutional democratic rule of law abiding concept of the executive power. Pape, from the point of view of executive power, need not be nearly so troubling. Why? Because Pape does not need to involve a prerogative in that first or narrow sense. It need not involve a coercive power. It need not involve a claim that the Crown has anything other, the executive government has anything other than powers possessed by ordinary people, including the power to spend money. It is a troubling and difficult case from the point of view of the federal distribution of powers. There's no getting away from that. But from the point of view of executive power, the decision need not confirm the broad theory of Vidalis that the scope of the first part of executive power, the coercive part, responds to the exigencies of a modern state. So I think if you distinguish those two and read the language carefully, language of the Obiter comments carefully, need not reach a conclusion that the executive power of the prerogative kind, if we're using UK language, is expanded in quite the way that Duncan talks about. If you look at the joint judgment in Pape, that distinction continues to be drawn between the prerogative in the narrow sense and the capacities of the government, and the response to exigencies could be seen as falling within that breadth of distribution, spheres of responsibility, rather than the structure of the executive. Chapter 2, what's positive about the broad dicta? There's no getting away from the fact that the broad dicta do suggest a departure from the separation of these two aspects of the executive power. What's nice is that the suggestion that Section 61 is not to be treated as a species of the royal prerogative could be read as suggesting that the royal connection is to be downplayed, and that would be consistent with a range of earlier cases. That would be attractive from the constitutionalist standpoint that I'm taking, because it downplays the element of personal power and the element of arbitrary power that are associated with the prerogative as the personal residual or vestigial powers of the monarch. If, as has been suggested on a number of occasions today, the constitutional authority derives from the Australian people, a proposition which hasn't figured that much in the judgments of late. I think if we counted its distribution over time, the time series of references to popular sovereignty and its cognates, I think we'd see a decline in recent years. But if it still derives from the Australian people, as I'd say it should, then a view of Section 61 that displaces the personal royal element would be very attractive, particularly if we take a civic republican account of the Constitution. Second, that downplaying of personal arbitrary power would support Duncan's argument that statutory displacement of executive power should be easier rather than harder. I note that Duncan referred to Oates and Jarrett and a line of cases that suggest that the High Court is open to a more flexible, a greater willingness to accept that statute displaces executive power. I do note, however, that in Cadia, the joint judgment still refers to the orthodox position in Barton. It refers to the position in Barton as being orthodox. That is, that clear and plain language is required in order to displace non-statutory executive power. So I think there is still a bit of work to be done in that area. And the third element the third positive point about the moving away from the language of the royal prerogative would suggest that a greater openness to judicial review of all aspects of executive power, unless precluded by the subject matter of the power, for example, matters of national security or foreign relations. So I found three good things to say about those broad dicta, but I still don't like them. Can I remind you of the language that I'm talking about? It's the language in PAPE that where the Chief Justice suggests that executive power has to be capable of serving the proper purposes of a national government, where in Vidalis he had talked about similar language, which I won't pause over now. There is similar language in Ditford and passages, dicta in Cadia that resonate with this idea. Why is this troubling? I see it as a reversion to 17th century thinking, specifically that of John Locke and some of his contemporaries. It's thinking that carried over into the 18th century but was well and truly in retreat in the 19th century. This is the idea that the prerogative at that point was a reserve of discretionary power held in the person of the king to meet the urgent needs of unforeseen and uncertain occurrences. Specifically, the power to defend the realm, invoking coercive, non-consensual power if necessary. Why is that troubling? Well, a lot's changed, a lot of water under the bridge and a lot of heads rolling on floors between the time of that language and today. But even Dicey's view of the prerogative was very different. For by the time of Dicey, and therefore 30, 40 years ahead of the drafting of the federal constitution, the prerogative powers were seen very much as vestigial and residual. That is the context in which the Constitution was drafted. The idea of an executive power that responds to the needs of the nation across all of those dimensions, not only of capacity to engage in legal relations, the capacities that government shares with you and me, but also in the coercive, non-consensual dimension, is not just not 21st century, it's not even 19th century in its constitutional ideology. It is therefore, I mean, this is why I'm troubled by the language in this judgment. I'm troubled too by the way both the Chief Justice and the Joint Judgment in Cadia didn't see the prerogative as a list of fossilized, ossified, whatever, powers, but as a body of principles, a body of rules that had principles behind them, principles that were capable of breathing new life and new interpretation into the content of the prerogative. In dicta, both judgments refer to the principle, the rationale for the prerogative over royal minds. What purpose was it intended to serve? As part of the reason, part of the reasoning process for distributing it between federal and state government. That, I would suggest, is not a positive way forward. But Duncan may be right. The writing may be on the wall. It may be too late to go back to a distinction between prerogative in the strict sense and capacities. A broad approach to the capacities, I would suggest, and not to the prerogative, a capacity to respond to national emergency and national needs, is entirely consistent with the language of Justice Jacobs and Justice Mason in the AAP case, entirely consistent with the language of Justice Brennan in Davis. We could confine the nationhood power, to use a very short shorthand, to the capacities and not adopt the dicta in Vidalis, it's ratio pretty much in Vidalis, but the dicta in Pape, extending in that way. But if it's too late, what can be done? Here I find the writing of Israeli academic Margit Cohen very challenging. In a series of papers in the OJ Oxford Journal of Legal Studies and in public law, she has set out a set of prescriptions for what can be done to hold the third source powers in check, that's the capacities of the Crown. And her chief interlocutor in this debate is a professor from Auckland, Bruce Harris. Margaret Cohn's prescription consists of five principles. A very strong principle of residuality, that is, non-statutory power is easily displaced by statute. Non-statutory powers should not be invoked where recognised and protected human rights are affected. Perhaps given the difficulty the High Court has with the idea of human rights, we can translate that to non-statutory powers should not be invoked where liberty is affected. And then you see a strong connection to the reasoning in M61, where the court was a case that was presented to the High Court as one being about a non-statutory processing power was transformed into one where the court saw the power as deriving from statute. Non-statutory powers should not be used for long-standing, high-impact, socially sensitive, or other issues of national importance. Now, call me crazy, but I cannot see the High Court buying a principle cast in those terms. I think they're the most. It is a classically Israeli constitutional principle. It has the fingerprints of Chief Justice Barak all over it. Makes perfect sense in the Israeli context, but it is not the kind of principle that could be used to control non-statutory executive power in Australia anytime soon. I'll skip over the fourth principle. The fifth one is anxious judicial review. That is a heightened approach to judicial review of non-statutory powers for a Gagler type reason, because the political avenues for accountability are less. A couple of challenges here. One is the general reluctance of the High Court to differentiate between standards and levels of review. And second, its reluctance to clearly state that non-statutory powers are reviewable in the same way as statutory powers, statutory executive powers are. I think the final reservation I have about Cohn's approach is that it puts the court front and centre in constraining non-statutory executive power. And in many instances, that's going to be a place where the court is just reluctant to go because of the nature of the powers and the nature of the questions that are thrown up. It's one thing to define the existence of a power, as in Vidalis, quite another to review the substance of its exercise. That is a big leap in the Australian constitutional tradition. An alternative is that put forward by Bruce Harris, which is effectively that non-statutory powers, at least the capacity powers, should be put on a statutory basis. Adam Tompkins, a Scottish writer, goes further and says the prerogative needs to be abolished as well and put on a statutory basis. Sounds good. The difficulty is that it's hard to see how any statutory formulation of those powers would be any more helpful than the elliptical and elusive words of Section 61. After all, this is a problem that's been with us for a long while. It's not that we've only just recently noticed that Section 61 does not contain the answer to how it should be interpreted, how the power should be defined. Justice Isaacs said as much in as few words in the Wooltops case those many years ago. So I think you can see now why I won't offer a theory or a solution. It is a genuinely hard and difficult problem. I hope that we don't have to confront the full horror laid out by Duncan, and that some modest retreat by the High Court from the full language in Vidalis and Pape might see the nationhood aspects, the responding to national exigencies, confined to the consensual and non-coercive powers of the executive government's capacities. Thank you.
Well, good afternoon, everybody. I am going to touch on issues of Section 61, but move on fairly quickly to examine a response to these, moving into a Republican constitution. But the point I wanted to make as well is that I think some of these issues can be dealt with even if we don't move toward a republic, but I just don't think that will occur. I think it will only occur when we do move in that direction, and the moment will be most propitious then. But the way I want to structure my discussion is, you know, very, very briefly to touch on one aspect of Section 61 that perhaps hasn't been touched on yet, and also to offer a small solution, but I don't think it's the best solution, but I will make an attempt. And then I will move on to my brief this afternoon, which was to discuss the Winterton thesis as far as a Republican constitution was concerned. So I will do that, highlighting the key elements in Winterton's thesis, starting off with the pre-referendum position. And as most of you are probably aware, he did draft a constitution prior to the 1999 referendum, which was used very much as a model, but there were certain critical aspects of it which weren't relied on, and George was concerned about aspects of the reserve powers and so on. But I'll deal with that. But I'll also then deal with his post-referendum reflections, as I've indicated, in the sense that he had to move on. He had to take into account what had occurred, and he also had to take into account the fact that there was a preponderance of public opinion, it would seem, in favour of direct election. And George was fairly committed, as you're aware, to a republic. And I think even though he was very much opposed to direct election, definitely preferring parliamentary election of a president, I think he was keen enough to try to reconcile those positions. But what had also occurred, and I say this just by way of introduction, and I see Sir Gerard Brennan is here with us this afternoon, I understand that there was a degree of discussion between them, and I'll leave it to Sir Gerard if you wanted to ask him if he can disclose any of that discussion. But for what I can see, there was a movement in the ideas of the two men to such an extent where I think if we do move forward, the Winterton thesis, I think, will become the Winterton-Brennan thesis in the sense that aspects of both can be accommodated to arrive at a solution, although there are disagreements between them on certain key points, which I'll mention. And the further development, I suppose, if I might say modestly or immodestly, is the Winterton-Brennan thesis with the Durangellis footnote, which I'll mention in a minute. So going to the fundamentals of the Winterton thesis, of course, has already been mentioned that the starting point is the breadth-depth analysis of Winterton, which I won't repeat, but the critical point in that thesis was that in the maintenance limb of Section 61, of course, George argued that the depth component in the maintenance limb, that is, what activities can actually be undertaken by the executive absent statutory authority, was to be limited by the common law prerogative powers of the Crown. And for Winterton, that was the safest option because they could not be expanded, A, and B, they were inherently subject to legislative control, being common law prerogatives. And of course, having predeceased Pape, I do think that he would have disapproved of what did occur in Pape, but we'd have to live with that. I'm not as confident as Simon is about limitations that might arise. I am, I think, more in Duncan's camp about the result of Pape, and I'm not sure if the distinction was... You could draw the distinction of capacities and the narrow prerogative on the facts of Pape, but whether the language in Pape will enable us to do that is another question. Now, why that is problematic is that we tend to neglect, if not the elephant in the room, at least the annoying mosquito, and that's the separation of powers. Because if you say that there is an element of executive power that is derived from Section 61 of the Constitution to be defined according to that nationhood concept, you are establishing an inherent executive power. Now, if that exists as an inherent executive power, you then apply the separation of powers to that, And the argument then becomes that Parliament cannot affect that. Now, some of you might think, and I've had this reaction before when I've presented this paper elsewhere, oh, that couldn't possibly be the case. But let me give you an example. The very eminent Commonwealth Solicitor General, Sir Maurice Byas, made this comment. He said that Parliament could not validly, I quote, take away any power which the Constitution gives to the Executive, and that no function of the Executive may constitutionally be discharged by the Parliament. Now, you might say, all very well and good, and it would be all very well and good if we were referring to the specific powers that the Constitution gives to the Governor-General. But Sir Maurice made an error when he then went on to give an example of this, the treaty-making power. He said, consequently, while Parliament could regulate the exercise of the government's treaty-making power, no law of the Parliament could take it away directly or indirectly. But where does the treaty-making power come from? You see, if we apply the PAPE test to that, what we're saying is it's no longer common law prerogative, but it exists inherently in Section 61. It not being common law, can we then say that Parliament can take that, regulate or take that power away? It's a general executive power. It's not one of those specifically granted powers. Now, it may not be a problem. We may not get there. But I think that these errors, perhaps, or these misconstruing what is inherently executive and what isn't, may cause us difficulties. And one of the reasons that Winterton drafted certain sections of his constitution was to overcome some of these powers. Now, we must, as I say, distinguish between these inherent executive powers which exist, or general executive power, which is in Section 61, and the other specifically conferred powers elsewhere. Now, I suppose the solution that I was going to suggest, because Chief Justice French did suggest last year that he did invite people to come forward with, how can we limit the executive power following PAPE and so on. My initial reaction was that the gate's been left open and the horse has bolted, but what I can suggest is this. It may be possible to say that even though the general executive power now exists in its modern form in Section 61, no longer limited by the prerogative, implied in Section 61 is one characteristic of the prerogative which goes with it, and that's it's inherently subject to legislative control. Now, if we take that forward, we still might get certain expressions of Section 61 power which perhaps we're uncomfortable with, but at least we know Parliament can control it. And I think that could be done by a simple implication, which I don't think would be going too far. The other problem with Section 61, once you take away the prerogative, is that, as we've indicated, how on earth do you possibly define it, even according to those nationhood powers or nationhood concepts? Now, this brings us to the next part of the paper, which is simply to discuss some of the aspects of George Winterton's amendments. Winterton was not dogmatic at the end of the day as to how we should treat Section 61, but he was able to say, and I think correctly, that there are sufficient uncertainties there that warrant some attention. So what he submitted in his draft constitution was that, in order to remove any doubt, that the power that's conferred by Section 61, I quote, shall be subject to the legislative power of the Commonwealth. So his new Section 61 read as follows, if I can just briefly read it. He submitted that it should read as follows. The executive power of the Commonwealth is vested in the President and is exercisable on the advice of the Federal Executive Council, the Prime Minister or other ministers, and extends to the execution and maintenance of this constitution of the laws of the Commonwealth. Well, that's fairly similar to what we have. But the third part of the new Section 61 states as follows. The executive power of the Commonwealth shall be subject to the legislative power of the Commonwealth. And that removes any doubt that it is so. And I think that particular provision, that 61.3, would be particularly valuable following the Pape decision. Now, he's reinforced this view by adding a new 51.40 to his Republican constitution. And the new 51.40 says the following, that, of course, the Parliament shall have power to make laws for peace, order and good government of the Commonwealth with respect to the exercise of any power vested in its constitution in the President in Council, or any other person or authority exercising the executive power of the Commonwealth. So a law can be made by Parliament to provide for some control over executive power, just removing any ambiguity. But he also added the following section, which is simply, if I can paraphrase it, that when it comes to an exercise of a so-called reserve power by the President, a law can still be made with respect to that, but it shall not be taken to have been passed unless it has been approved by at least a two-thirds majority of the members of each House of the Parliament. That's in order to ensure that any laws which regulate the exercise of reserve powers are not politically motivated and that there is agreement. Now, the proposed section 5140 would also apply to the laws, to the powers specifically vested in the Governor-General, of course, including the reserve powers. Now, the next part looks more precisely at the reserve powers. Now, Winterton was of the view that the Governor-General or President should have no power to act without or contrary to ministerial advice except in extraordinary emergency situations. He went on to say that if the Governor-General or President objects to this advice, then the right to warn may be exercised, but if persisted in, the Governor-General or President must give way and accept it. But of course, there is always the possibility of statutory definition of the powers outlined above. Now, in relation to the reserve powers, I don't think that Winterton wanted these to be defined constitutionally, problems of petrification and so on. But he did believe that there could be a statutory definition of these reserve powers because it's, of course, much easier to amend legislation if it proves to be effective. So for this reason, he proposed a constitutional amendment which gives Parliament the constitutional authority to enact relevant legislation, as I've indicated. Now, his new section 60, capital A, states as follows, if I might read it briefly. Except insofar as the Parliament, in accordance with section 5140, otherwise provides, the President shall exercise and perform his powers and functions in accordance with the constitutional conventions which related to the exercise and performance of the powers and functions of the Governor-General, but nothing in this section shall have the effect of overturning, of converting constitutional conventions into rules of law. In other words, absent Parliament passing the relevant legislation, the current conventions would apply. He went on to say that the Prime Minister shall keep the President fully informed concerning the general conduct of the government and shall furnish the President with such information as he may request with respect to any particular matter relating to the government. So, if I can just quickly summarise, what Winterton is suggesting is that we continue with the present situation of applying to the reserve powers using the principles of responsible government and the conventions arising thereunder to regulate them, but he does provide for the possibility of legislation to regulate their conduct. Now, the great difficulty for Winterton was, of course, the direct election issue. And as I've indicated to you, and I think as we all know, it appears to be, if we are to move to a republic, that this issue must somehow be addressed. And before I look at the Winterton proposal, and this is why I'm beginning to think that the combination of Winterton and Brennan is probably the way forward. In his Winterton lecture last night, Sir Gerard proposed the establishment of an electoral college to appoint a president, which perhaps is a middle way between the direct election and Parliament, or two-thirds majority of each House of Parliament electing a president. But that will be in Sir Gerard's paper, and I have not had a chance to digest it as yet, but I think it's a proposal worth considering carefully. Now, the difficulty with direct election, Winterton was of the view, and I think Sir Gerard was contrary to this, but Winterton believed that if we do move to a direct election, there must be at least a partial codification of the reserve powers. And he advocated that the proposals put forward by the Republic Advisory Committee on this point would be desirable. And if I can quickly just summarise them, of course, it's the essential principles. That what should be codified is the fundamental principle that the President is granted only such power as is absolutely necessary to enforce the fundamental constitutional principles of the rule of law and representative and responsible government, and that the Constitution should provide that after a general election, the President should appoint as Prime Minister the person most likely to enjoy the confidence of the House of Representatives, and the President should be obliged to refuse a dissolution of Parliament to a Prime Minister who has lost a constructive no-confidence motion. Also, to a Prime Minister who is facing a no-confidence motion, one which is pending, in other words, and before the House of Representatives has met after a general election, unless the House has proved unable to elect a Speaker. Now, more difficult to codify, of course, is the controversial reserve power to dismiss the Prime Minister, and thus the government. This power should probably only be exercisable if the Prime Minister refuses to comply with an order of the High Court, has contravened a fundamental constitutional provision, or perhaps more questionably, a fundamental constitutional principle. These are difficult questions, but at least I think what he's indicating, at least the first two, not complying with an order of the High Court or a clear illegality on the part of Prime Minister, may warrant dismissal. And then it should be constitutionalised that the exercise of power in the interstices of the reserve powers, these should continue to be governed by the established constitutional conventions. The Constitution should expressly provide for the continuation of the present conventions, notwithstanding the abolition of the monarchy, and provide for their continuing evolution. Now, I think it's at this point of codification where there is a difference between Sir Gerard and Winterton. I think Sir Gerard feels that a codification just would not be possible to cover all circumstances. And here we come to the further evolution. And I think this, from my own perspective, has a lot to commend it. And I'm not sure to what extent the two proponents here, Winterton and Brennan, worked on this together, or whether they initially thought of this separately and then came together. Perhaps Sir Gerard could let us know at some later point. But the idea developed that there should be a constitutional council set up to advise a president on the exercise of the reserve powers. And this would be particularly needful if we had a directly elected head of state who lacked the experience of law and government. I mean, there are clear dangers, and you don't need me here to articulate them. Now, this constitutional council, or this idea of a constitutional council, had developed in the mind of George Winterton, but I think it was Sir Gerard Brennan that took it further and developed the notion, and I would like simply to outline it here this afternoon. Sir Gerard noted the impossibility of foreseeing all the circumstances in which the reserve powers might have to be exercised, and thus he necessitated a procedure which firstly prescribes a general criterion for determining the occasions when a presidential power might be exercised without ministerial advice, and secondly provides an enforcement mechanism that reduces the role of judicial supervision to a minimum. Thus, Brennan advocated that the exercise of reserve powers be only permitted, I quote, when the President is of the opinion on reasonable grounds that it is absolutely necessary to exercise such a power in order to secure compliance with the general law or the effective working of parliamentary democracy in accordance with the law and custom of the Constitution. Then there would be a constitutional council to certify either conclusively that reasonable grounds exist for the President's opinion, in other words, to exercise reserve powers, or that the council concurs in the President's opinion. Now, the preferred option, and I'll finish with this, the preferred option is the first, that the Constitutional Council must certify conclusively that reasonable grounds exist for the President's opinion, because then it remains for the President to actually make the decision. There are certain issues there which we can discuss. You could ask me questions if you wish, but I better leave it there at that point. But I think this notion of a constitutional council has a lot to commend it. The final check and balance in this whole system, if we want to be extra cautious, is to require, and I'll finish on this, that a president who does dismiss a prime minister, even you know, via the concurring advice of a constitutional council, should vacate their office forthwith, either permanently or make themselves subject to re-election, thus ensuring that a president is fully aware that there are serious consequences for the action they are taking. Now, I'm conscious of the time, and I do apologise. I wish I could have organised this paper a little bit better in terms of the time, but the time was a constraint. But I'm happy to take any questions, and I will be publishing a paper on these matters. So thank you very much.
Thanks, Peter. Any questions? There must be some. Well, where?
Brian Pape. Thank you for your papers, gentlemen. I was wondering if I could ask a question to Professor Gerandros, and that deals with the issue of limiting the executive power. I take it that what you're suggesting is that as the judicial power is administered through the Judiciary Act, you would envisage something along the lines of an Executive Power Act passed by the Parliament, which would in some way limit the power of the executive, example, just confirming that the executive power refers to the prerogative power. Is that what you're suggesting?
What is being suggested, yes, is something like that. What it's permitted to thesis that, yes, the Parliament would pass a law which regulates the exercise of both reserve powers and also the specifically granted powers in the Constitution. That's correct. But if it's a reserve power, it's got to be a 2-by-2-thirds majority.
Any other questions? Peter Bailey?
Yes, it's Peter Bailey, and what I was really wanting to do is to contribute a kind of different perspective to what Duncan Kerr and Simon Evans were saying. You see, if you come from a human rights perspective rather than from, as it were, our legal base, you have an equality in terms of the recognition of importance of both economic and social and civil and political rights. And we tend to sort of skirt around the economic and social rights and say, well, of course, the real emergencies are in the defence security area. Now, what I'm wondering is whether, in that sense, PAPE is beginning to be the kind of, beginning to establish criteria for the recognition of ESC rights as really important rights in the community. And what I'm wondering also is whether we ought to be starting to get stuck into these military and these strategical people and say, look, it's time you were accountable and that you should not be allowed to go to war ever, ever. And this is, of course, what happened in the 90s. although it wasn't formally war, that was part of the problem. You can't have hostilities without some kind of look by the Parliament or by some emergency council, and you can't just do that any more than you should do it in economic and social areas. So it's just a kind of a thought, and I wondered if you'd like to comment on that.
I wish I could read it in that way, but I think it's a long bow, and I think it's an awfully long way from the words that their honours used.
I haven't got anything to add to what Duncan said about how to read PAPE. And if you read M61, there's a passage in which the court almost, despite later in the judgment accepting the Mason view from FAR and Winicky about conferral of benefits attracting certain minister obligations, there's a passage earlier in the judgment which seems to view the threats to liberty as coming from the positive actions of the government rather than from not conferring benefits. I think the classic liberal mindset is still very strong in the legal imagination, and it's a long way off recognising ESC rights as something that would fit within the paper rubric, I'm afraid.
I must say, Simon, that when you were making your distinction between coercive and natural person powers, I was wondering how many people other than Rupert Murdoch could have spent, in Mr. Pape's case, $8.1 billion. It's not a distinction which has fared well.
No. I think that its survival depends on... in the modern world, we should find, within the legal resources, we have means of controlling the non-coercive, what classic non-coercive powers, using the same techniques for the reasons that Peter gives, that that they have similar effects on modern understandings of liberty.
That's right, the checkbook and governance.
The checkbook governance, absolutely. Mm. But there is still power in the distinction if it can rein in some of the language in pay.
Okay. Do we have some other questions or comments? Well, then it remains only for me to thank our three speakers and to ask you to do likewise. It's very wonderful.
Thanks very much, Mark. Well, good afternoon, and thank you for staying with us for the duration of the day. It's impressive to stand here and see so many people who have lasted over such a stimulating and absorbing day, but I do appreciate that it can take its toll. I'd like to start by thanking, obviously, our speakers throughout the day for really delivering an outstanding set of stimulating papers. Someone complained to me at lunch and saying, you have it in this great venue and you told us all these interesting things that are in this building and I cannot find a weak link in the program that I could go and spend some time looking at Entombed Warriors. I need to go to every part of the program. And as a complaint, it's a great compliment. The success of the event obviously depends on our speakers, and we're very grateful for the work that they put into preparing those papers. I should remind you, as reference has been made, that many of the papers will be available on the Centre's website over the next week or so as speakers finish them and provide them to us. Additionally, I would like to thank our chairpersons, Mark, Justices Finn and McLennan, for getting us to the end of the day and moving us through the proceedings so charmingly and capably. I'd also like to thank those who have helped with the organisation of this event. My colleagues in the Gilbert and Tobin Centre have all assisted with planning and...